Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
JBR Capital has sponsored the Intercooler podcast for several months now. You've probably heard me talk about the company before. In that time, I've come to really understand what it is that makes JBR Capital different to other car finance companies. If I had to boil it down to one thing, I'd say it's this. Car finance is all JBR Capital does. Might sound like a minor detail, that, but in fact it's really important. It means JBR Capital has a profound understanding of the car marketplace and of car buyers, an understanding that other finance companies could only hope to have. In fact, that very focused approach is exactly why the company was started in the first place. We recently had Darren Selig, founder of JBR Capital, on the podcast, episode 106, if you want to go back and listen. And he explained that he started the company when he realized that general finance lenders actually didn't understand cars or car buyers particularly well at all. So he spotted that gap in the market and he founded JBR Capital to fill it. So before you buy your next car, be it a supercar, sports car, classic car, a hypercar, or a luxury car, even if it's a brand new car, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side. And it really helps us if you tell them that the Intercooler sent you. JBR Capital is authorized and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Welcome to the Intercooler podcast.
Welcome to episode 119 of the podcast, everybody. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you here. And Andrew, we're talking about the great road races, Mille Miglia, Targa Florio, Carrera Panamericana, others in there as well. There's a whole lot to get stuck into. I think for a lot of people, we're going to be referencing a golden age of motorsport. Do you see it that way? I bet you do.
It's difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, the reason it's a golden age of motorsport is because it stopped a long time ago, and it stopped a long time ago because people kept dying.
Yeah, it was dangerous.
Yeah, I do. I do regard it as a golden age of motorsport, and the people. The only thing I find sort of in any way ethically difficult is when, you know, crowds and spectators get caught up in it, because as we know that has happened in the past. But you know, I think if drivers, I've always thought this, you know, knowing the risk they take. They're taking on, want to get in cars and do that. Then, you know, I've always thought that that's their decision. And there were some epic events, and you know, just those three that you named, they're some of the most, you know, revered races names in all of motorsport. And it'll be nice to have just to sort of talk about them and the challenge of driving them. Not that even I'm old enough to have done any of them properly, but I've been around all the circuits, and they're just completely different to, I mean, motor racing as we know it today, compared to what it was when they were doing it. It's almost a different sport, and I think probably rightly so. But there were some epic events back then, I sort of grew up on them, and the drivers and the histories and the, so we'll get into all of it, but
Yeah,
it's kind of sad that they were gone, but they also have no place in modern motorsport.
They had to go, didn't they, really? So before we get stuck in, let me just do another website reminder, and we're going to keep pushing this because it's important to us. But our new website went live almost a couple of weeks ago. The-intercooler.com. Go and check it out. It's our new home. It's the Intercooler's new home. You can start take out a subscription, and you'll start with a one-month free trial. Just as a reminder, actually, for existing app subscribers who are wondering how to get into the website, go to the app first. That's what you need to do. Go to the app first, find the page along the top called Website, and then follow the instructions in there. It will take you seconds, and you'll have full access to the website. That's what you need to do if you're an app subscriber. All right, then. Well, let's talk about these races a bit more broadly. I mean, I've named three there. There are others, but it's kind of difficult to know where to stop, including road races in this sort of category, because Le Mans was a road race, Spa initially was a road race. What is it that we're talking about really then?
I think it's a conceptual thing, isn't it? There's no such thing as a formal definition of what a road race is. I mean, you know, to an extent, the Monaco Grand Prix is still a road race insofar as it's entirely held on public roads. But, you know, years and years back, almost all races were road races because there were no racetracks. I mean, Brooklands was the first purpose-built racetrack. It just predated Indianapolis, 1907. But, you know, if you think of all the places that, you know, we think of as, you know, racetracks today, you know, okay, so, you know, take Spa. I mean, that's just, you know, the original Spa was just a load of roads connected together. Le Mans was exactly the same. So, you know, were the early Le Mans, which, you know, I think the Le Mans was run entirely on public roads until, I'm just trying to think, probably the 70s when they got rid of the White House Corner and produced the Porsche Curves. Pretty much all of that was, and as we know, you know, probably what, even today, more than half a lap takes place on public roads. So what is a road race? I mean, I see it as something which is held over enormous distances, where you have laps of not 7 or 8 miles, but 70 or 80 miles, or, you know, really, really long laps. I mean, okay, here's one way of perhaps looking at it. It's a race where drivers couldn't reasonably be, unless they were locals, reasonably expect to learn the circuit in any kind of conventional time period. And so there was actually a different discipline. You know, you had to drive them in a different way because you couldn't learn where every lump, bump, breaking point, turning point, apex, exit, every camber change, every surface change, all that sort of stuff, which even at a place like the Nürburgring, if you go there enough, you can learn all that stuff. You know, somewhere like the Carrera Panamericana, which was a 3,000-kilometer race, you're just not going to do it. Somewhere like the Mille Miglia, and I think the Carrera too. Another problem that drivers have is they kept on changing the course. And the Mille Miglia, it's called 1,000 miles. Sometimes, you know, that race was thick end of 1,100 miles long. I think there was one which is under 900. So it was an entirely nominal, notional thing. And so you could never learn the course. And so, you know, that, I guess, is the big characteristic. You're talking about long, long laps. So, yeah, I think that's... And how do you distinguish that from rallying? Well, rallying doesn't have sort of laps, does it? But then again, you know, rallying is still, I guess, today a form of road racing, isn't it? You still got cars, you know... certainly tarmac rallies, screaming down public roads, you know, bouncing off trees and so on. So, yeah, but that's how I kind of think of it.
I think the fact is there are all these disciplines of racing overlap slightly, don't they? So the boundaries are kind of fuzzy, but yet we know what we're talking about, and we probably all just innately, inherently appreciate the difference between the Targa Florio and Le Mans. We can see how it's a different, slightly different discipline. Really, nothing exists like it today, at least not on four wheels. Because if you go to the Isle of Man at the right time in the summer, and you'll watch motorbikes screaming round the Snaefell mountain course, that has got to be about as close as we get these days, isn't it?
certainly when I was there, that's the kind of sense that you, there is a sense of you are watching something from another age. Okay, the bikes are state of the art and, you know, and everything else, but when you're sitting at the side of the road and the bikes are coming past you, sometimes not feet, but inches away from you, and there is nothing between you and them. And, you know, and we know about the, you know, the tragedies that happen up there. Then yeah, you do get that sense of a of existing briefly in another era, where life was an awful lot cheaper than it is now. And I think, you know, and I think I said so at the time, I think that's the closest you can get to having an idea of what it was like to spectate at a real Mille Miglia, not the rerun they have these days, or real Targa Florio, or the Carrera Panamericana, where there was no safety because the, you know, the tracks were too long to marshal. You certainly couldn't have put barriers up. You know, there'd be the, you know, there would be marshal posted, and there might be the odd hay bale at well-known accident spots. But, you know, you'd also, you know, you'd be driving along, and if, you know, the local farmer, you know, decided he needed to, you know, move his cows from one field to the next, you know, that was another thing, you know, wild dogs, you know, all sorts of wildlife, you know, stray people, and that was all, and the crowds, you know, there was nothing between, you know, and, you know, there are some, you know, there are some terrifying stories that came back from things like the Mille Miglia of drivers just having to drive at three-figure speeds through crowds, hoping they get out of the way. It is all fairly unimaginable, but it happened. It happened.
So it's something that there's something adventurous and intrepid about this form of racing, but also it's very, it's super dangerous. There's no question about that. And drivers are not just up against their cars, up against the competition, not just up against the conditions like they are in any other form of motorsport, but also against the terrain, the environment, the landscape. I suppose it's only rally drivers who still face that sort of challenge these days.
But think about a modern rally car. You know, you and I have seen rally cars, you know, have the most unbelievable accidents. I mean, the most, you know, which in any other era would have resulted in, you know,
a fireball,
calamity, and they walk away. You know, thank goodness. I mean, it does happen, particularly with spectators. But in fact, you know, drivers and co-drivers, it's very, very rare, isn't it, these days that, you know, that the worst happens. Whereas, you know, way back, it was an accepted part of, and that's another thing that you has in common with the Isle of Man. It is accepted these days on the Isle of Man that during the course of that event, a number of people will die. It's part of, nobody wants it, but everybody accepts it, that it is just going to happen. If you want to have an event like that, that is what is going to happen. And back in the days of road racing in cars, it was absolutely accepted that people would die. And they did, in their droves. Not just drivers, but spectators too.
Yeah, during the TT this year, I think I saw more sort of controversy around that, particularly on social media, than I have done in previous years. And I just wonder if that's going to become more and more of an issue for the Isle of Man TT and for its organisers. I wonder if attitudes are just going to change around that in the coming years. I suppose we'll see. What were the origins then of road racing? How far do we have to go back?
Well, I mean, technically 1894, okay, which was only, 8 years after the accepted birth of the car. The first one was from Paris to Rouen, which I think is about 80 miles. There were over 100 entrants. Only 17 finished. It was won by, there were cars in that race which were, get this, they were powered by, well, all the things you'd expect. So petrol, electricity and steam.
Yeah.
But there are cars in the entry list whose source of power is described as gravity.
Well, that's only going to work for part of the course, isn't it?
Well, I guess you just get out and push it the rest of the way. I don't know. But by 1903, so less than 10 years later, you had these massive road races. The one I'm going to reference is the Paris-Madrid road race. You know, long way, 1903, and you had cars big things like Panhards and Mercedes and Moors, and these cars were capable of 80, 90 miles an hour. But they still had, they were still in all other regards totally primitive. So they'd actually gained the ability to go very fast, but absolutely not the ability to go around corners or stop or do anything else. And that race was carnage. That was one race. I think 8 people died in it, including Marcel Renault, one of the Renault brothers, and his brother Louis was in it too. And you know, but by then, you know, road racing was the way people, because there were no tracks. And then you got things like the Peking Paris, the 1907 Peking Paris. Well, literally there were, I think, only about 8 cars set off from Peking. Most of them actually made it, astonishingly enough. It was won by Prince Scipione Borghese in an Itala, which is an amazing looking thing. But they literally, they drove them from, well, what was then Peking to Paris. There was one bloke, two people who broke down somewhere in the Gobi Desert, and they only survived by drinking the water in their radiator. So, you know, so by 1907, 115 years ago, it was, you know, road racing was a massive thing, and it wasn't, you know, let's see if we can get this car to the shops. It was drive across continents in these things, and it kind of evolved from there. And, you know, by, well, even by then, the Targa Florio had started. 1906, I think, was the first one of those. And it was happening all over the place. You know, the French Grand Prix in Dieppe was held over a 47-mile lap. There was also a French Grand Prix at Le Mans, which has held over an enormous circuit, but nowhere near the current one is. So, yeah, I mean, it did establish itself very quickly. And as I said, because there were no circuits, they were all road races. But, yeah, so that's how it started.
OK, we'll come back to the Targa Florio in a moment. But let's talk Mille Miglia. First ran in 1927. It's a bit like Fawlty Towers, the Mille Miglia, because... It's Fawlty Towers. You assume it ran for years and years and years because it's such a popular, well-loved show. In fact, there are only ever 12 episodes. The Mille Miglia only ran 24 times. It was interrupted by war for a long time, of course. And actually, it seems totally bizarre to think of this now, but for a few years in the 50s, it was a round of the World Sports Car Championship. Because of that, you had the fastest work sports cars there. You had the fastest drivers there, over nominally 1,000 miles around Italy. And it's a single lap. And as you said, the route changed over the years. And sometimes it was more than 1,000 miles, sometimes less. It's only when you see the route of the Mille Miglia laid over a map of Italy that you realise just how far 1,000 or 1,000 or so miles really is. So they always started in Brescia in the north of Italy, not too far from Milan. And then the version of it that I had a look at the other day, it went down the coast to Rome, all the way on the west coast, all the way across Italy to the east coast, up the east coast, and back to Brescia. So it's such a long distance, and at full race speed the whole time. So, I mean, just imagine, you know how tiring it is to do... I'm sure you've done a 1,000-mile journey in a day. I did it. I did Bristol to Modena once, and I think that's 1,100 or something, just at normal road speeds, 70, 80 miles an hour. It's exhausting, yeah. And you're stopping...
Sitting on the motorway without having to think about anything else. Yeah.
Yeah. So, oh, yeah. We'll come on to Moss's run at the Mille Miglia shortly. Yeah.
But because, the first one,
yeah,
the first Mille Miglia took 23 hours... to get round the lap.
Yeah, well, it's not surprising, really. What was that in?
I knew you were going to ask me that. I can't remember. It would have been Italian. Okay, yeah. I'm going to ask you a question.
Go on.
How many times did non-Italian drivers win the Mille Miglia out of the 24 runnings?
3.
Very good. 2.
So Moss
Sterling
and...
in 55, Rudy Caracciolo in 1931. I'm not counting here the 1940 Mille Miglia, which was won by BMW, but it wasn't the Mille Miglia. It was like they had they mapped out a completely different circuit. It did start in Brescia, but never went anywhere near Rome, and it was short. It went from Brescia to Cremona to Mantua and back. It was like a 90-mile lap, and they went round it 10 times.
So that's
not the Mille Miglia. So yeah, so excluding the 1940 race, it was won twice by non-Italian drivers, and once, well, only one other mark, not, well, only one non-Italian mark has ever won it, which is Mercedes-Benz, which won it in 31 and 55. So there you go. It was absolutely an Italian benefit. And the point being is that local knowledge was everything. When Moss won it in 55, and I know we're going to come back to it, you know, he did something like 10 laps in road cars and race cars just to try and get his head around the circuit and make those famous pace notes and everything else. Whereas if you'd grown up in that part of the world and you'd been driving those, I mean, the advantages that you had in just knowing even bits of the route were, you know, insuperable, which is why, you know, Italians always did so incredibly well on it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I quite believe that even the locals, the Italians, knew every mile of it, every corner.
No,
but what
I
they can definitely learn is the bits that you have to know. So the dangerous bits or the pinch points. I absolutely believe that they can learn those bits, and the rest of it they can drive on site. So it's a huge advantage.
You know, they did it time and time again. You know, someone like Piero Taruffi, who won the last one in 1957. Now, again, I can't remember. I think he did his first. He might have done his first before the war. You know, he probably did 11 Mille Miglias. And if you think how many practice laps and how, you know, and the fact that he was an Italian and knew that part of the world well anyway, and the number of times he did it because it was always there, you know, you do just build, even though the course changes, you do just, and even if you don't know all of it, any areas where you know which way, that you know as well as I do, Dan, that if you know which way, how much faster you can get around a circuit, you know, than one you don't. I mean, it's the difference between being competitive and being absolutely hopelessly nowhere.
Yeah, I've been there.
So, yeah.
You could see why, given how long the route was. At its peak, it's estimated there were 5 million spectators. And so you can see why certain manufacturers were keen to do it and keen to try and win it, because it's huge exposure, isn't it? Okay, let's talk about 55 then. This was probably the most famous of them all, do you think, or is that just a British perspective?
No, but with that, well, okay, the only other one which has got it, which can, okay, there was 1930, I think, which is the one where Achille Varzi was leading and Nuvolari was gaining on him. And it must have been very late, I guess. It must have been towards the end of it. Because to fool Varzi, Nuvolari turned off his lights and drove in the dark. And by the time by the time Varzi realised he was there, he was past and gone. But not that one. No, so the only possible candidate as being as famous as 55 was sadly 57, and only because of the appalling accident that happened to De Portago and Ed Nelson that resulted in 16 people dying. But no, in terms of an actual race, you know, 55 is head and shoulders, knees and toes, the most famous of them all. Not just because it was won by Stirling, but because it was won in a record time that was never beaten by anybody. So yeah, definitely.
So yeah, Mercedes-Benz works team, the 300 SLR, which as we know was not a development of the 300 SL, despite the name. It was a W196 F1 car with a different body on top.
And a bigger engine, but yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that is a serious purpose-built racing car. And, of course, it was Jenks, Dennis Jenkinson, in the co-driver's seat as the navigator. And it's sometimes said, I think, isn't it, that this was the invention of pace notes, rally pace notes as we know them today. But I don't. That's actually not true. Similar systems had been used in the past. But I don't think there's any question that this method they came up with, Jenks and Moss, was
except this is one of the great Mille Miglia myths. Moss had nothing to do with the notes. I don't think that Jenks did. There's a bloke called John Fitch, who is a bit of a hero of mine, an American race driver, and he was due to drive in the Mille Miglia, and he had the idea of having a navigator to help. And he had the idea of creating pace notes for that navigator. And he led both the idea and the navigator to Stirling, because he knew he was in a standard 300 SL showroom car, so he knew he had no hope. And so, in an act of incredible kindness, he had the idea and he had the navigator, and he gave both to Stirling. And then what happened happened.
So, I mean, there wasn't an intercom between them, so they devised a series of hand signals, which Jenks would clearly, he'd deploy the right hand signal for what was coming up, and Moss would drive to that. And they had you can find pictures of this online. They called it the toilet roll, a mechanism for unrolling this scroll that contained all the notes for the entire route. And that's how they did it. And without that system, without that navigator, there's no way Moss would have been able to compete with the locals who had that local knowledge, as we've been discussing. So that was, I mean, that the car and Moss's driving is clearly what won it for them. Just imagine being Jenks sitting in that thing. I'm not a good passenger at the best of times, but can you imagine how exhilarating it would have been to witness firsthand?
That's one word for it, yeah.
One of the great feats of driving.
I mean, he did go off, Stirling did go, he did bin it a couple of times. I mean, the car went off the road at least twice.
You see the photos of it, don't you?
Once, I think they had to get the crowd to push him back on the road. And it was nearly a disaster. But Jenks was one of those. He was a sidecar racer. Okay, so I imagine that sitting next to Stirling was a bit of a, you know, bit of a busman's holiday for him, because he was used to sitting, you know, in the side of a sidecar. And there was one bit where he felt so ill, he had to lean over the side of the car to throw up. At which stage the wind stream pulled his glasses off. And he managed to get back into the car, dig around, find his spare glasses, which he brought with him, and he didn't miss a note.
Wow.
Yeah.
And yeah. Don't go thinking that this was 1955, so they're not going that fast. Do not be fooled. They were doing at times 170, 180 miles an hour?
Yeah, about that. Almost exactly that, yeah.
So
yeah,
175. Really,
I think 175 was the sort of documented top speed of the car. Which, yeah. Well, you know, the fact is, they averaged. I mean, they did it in. I should look this up. I used to know
10 hours, 7 minutes, and 48 seconds.
Oh, I was going to go 10.
992
okay.
miles.
Yeah, average of 98.4 miles an hour, something like that.
Yeah,
yeah. Okay, so they averaged. So that's how fast they went, and that averaged. Includes the time when they're stopping to change tyres, fill it up with fuel, check it out. I think Stirling had to have a pee at some stage, and they still averaged. So actually, on the road running time, their average speed was well over 100 miles an hour. So, you know, that's how.
For 10 hours?
For 10 hours, which was much less than half the length of time it took to complete the first Mille Miglia.
Yep.
10 hours. And then after that, Stirling went to, he did all the sort of victory stuff. He then went to the Mercedes-Benz party that evening. And having been to the Mercedes-Benz party, he drove to Stuttgart.
That's bananas, isn't it?
That's just Stirling. Stirling, and also I think Pat Fangio gave him some quite exciting pills.
Oh, right.
Which Stirling used to talk about. So, yes, by any modern standards, he wouldn't have been allowed in the race. But back then, people, you know, because you had to, didn't you? I mean, imagine, you know, driving on your own for 10 hours, you know, in a normal road car on a motorway, you'd be tired at the end of that. Imagine racing, yeah, around a course with several thousand corners. No one to take over the driving. You know, you're probably a bit wired, so you probably didn't get much sleep the night before. And then you go and do it. Of course you'd have to have something to keep you, you know, from, you know, passing out of the wheel, frankly.
Do you know, I didn't quite appreciate this until I started looking it up last week. But at this point, Moss was yet to win a World Championship Formula
Correct.
One Grand Prix.
Yeah. He was very much Fangio's understudy. He was the boy wonder. He was the coming man, but he hadn't got there yet. It was the first international massive win of his.
Yeah.
And it really did set him on course for greatness. I mean, he won the British Grand Prix very shortly after that, but yeah. No, you're absolutely right. He hadn't won a Grand Prix.
So it's a breakout performance for him, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was also, 24. Fangio was in that race in a similar car. Yep. And he didn't have a co-driver, which was his decision. And actually, I think it's almost a moral decision, wasn't it? I think he lost a friend who was navigating.
Urrutia, 1938, I think, yeah, and some big road race before the war. You're absolutely right.
And so he preferred to drive alone, which is, on a race, particularly the Mille Miglia, more than any other race has ever been, probably, that's a huge disadvantage. He did have technical issues with his car, but he finished 32 minutes behind Moss.
Yeah. But Stirling was, I mean, Stirling would say that Fangio was better than him in a Formula One car.
Mm.
But in a sports car, Stirling was just better than Fangio.
Mm. That's quite a thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. What a performance. And people think now that that car, 722, Moss's 300 SLR, is maybe the most valuable car in the world.
I think it has to be. Well, I mean, it's kind of that or the Uhlenhaut Coupe, but there's only one 722 and there are two Uhlenhaut Coupes.
Yeah,
must be. Must be the most valuable car in the world.
Bloody hell. What an event that was. All right, let's move on. Targa Florio.
Yes.
On Sicily.
One last thing.
Go on.
I just want to, because I have no way of proving this, but I just have one last thing, just a little thing to plant in your head. Okay. So in 1957, the race ends when De Portago's Ferrari has a puncture and he goes off the road and into the crowd and 16 people die. That meant that over the entire duration of the Mille Miglia, I think 56 people died in those 30 years, 24 races that they had it. I have often wondered how many people would have died on those roads during the normal course of stuff if there hadn't been a Mille Miglia. How many road traffic accidents in that over that 30-year period, over that 1,000-mile route, you know, it would during that time. I don't know. It may be that the Mille Miglia saved lives. It may be that fewer people died as a result of those roads being closed than would have done had they been open.
It's very possible. It's an interesting point. Yeah, because it's such an enormous course.
Exactly.
An interesting one to ponder. All right, Targa Florio then, on Sicily. Yeah.
Yes.
Now, my notes here say the world's oldest sports car racing event. I don't know if that can be backed up, can it? But it too was a round of the World Sports Car Championship.
Well, it's interesting. So is that all the... It's a different thing, you know. So the Tourist Trophy still happens today. There is a Tourist Trophy race today, but it's not tied to a location. It drifts around all over the place. So it's just the name of a race, which can be held anywhere. But that's the oldest race that's still. And also the other thing is the Tourist Trophy is still happening. But I think the first Tourist Trophy was in 1905. So it's not the same sort of thing. I think it is probably the oldest race that happened, you know, that happened on the same course, because it certainly predates the Indy 500, which is, I think, probably the most likely other competitor.
So, like the Mille Miglia, the Targa Florio, there were several different routes over the years. But I think the one that we kind of get worked up about now is the Piccolo Madonie, isn't it? The 45-mile
Little one. There were three. There was the big, the grande, and then there was a middle one. There was one in the middle, and the little one, the baby one, is 45 miles long.
And they do it 11 times.
Yeah.
Blah. Now, you wrote a piece about trying to retrace the route of the Targa Florio on your family holiday by Fiat Stilo. It's on the app on the website if you want to go and find it. But I just want to try and understand what the roads are like.
They're country lanes, but they're country lanes around mountainous countryside. So they are, you know, in the way of all country lanes, they're very narrow. But they also, you know, they're very, very windy. I mean, there are, you know, people go on about, you know, the Nürburgring's got 100 and whatever it is, 120, 130 corners. One lap of the Targa Florio was about 900.
Yeah.
About 900 corners. And, you know, you just... And I think what must have been most difficult about it, because, you know, you get to, you know, most circuits have, and to be fair, the Targa Florida, even the little circuit, did right at the very end of it have a big long straight. But you were at the end of the lap then. But for the rest of the time, you must have just never stopped. You never stopped turning. So there's no time at all to ever relax, just to sort of take a breather and just, you know, like, you know, drivers always, you know, legendarily did on the Mulsanne straight. They'd sort of, you know, they'd stretch their toes and they'd check the dials and they'd look out the window and they'd just give themselves a bit of a break from it. You never got that at the Targa Florio. It was just 45 miles of utter insanity from start to finish, where if something went wrong, you know, you either went off a ravine or into the side of a mountain. And so, you know, so the levels of concentration required must have just been absolutely incredible. And the drivers regarded it as, certainly, you know, after, you know, the Carrera and the Mille Miglia stop, they regarded it as one of the greatest challenges that any driver could ever go and take on, just because of the, and even though they had two drivers, because you'd have to, even to go, I think they sort of would do like three laps and four laps or something. And just to do a single stint there was absolutely exhausting. And I'm just, you know, having been around it, with my family, with my vomiting family in a Fiat Stilo station wagon, it is, well, I didn't even do a full lap, but I did enough of it to get a good idea of what it was like. Just unbelievable. I mean, you just couldn't race anything like round roads like that anymore.
To illustrate how tight and twisty it was, the fastest lap ever was set by Helmut Marko in an Alfa Romeo sports car. He did a lap in 33 minutes and 41 seconds, which is an average
Hang on, can I guess?
Go on. Yeah.
Well, I've got it in my head that no one did an 80-mile-an-hour lap. I don't think there was ever an 80-mile-an-hour lap done at the Targa Florio, so, of course.
Absolutely right, by the slimmest margin, because Marko did a 79.693-mile-an-hour
lap. Oh, okay.
So he's probably seconds shy, isn't he, of
oh, it must have been so annoying.
Yeah.
Well, maybe he's Austrian, he wouldn't care, because he'd be in kilometres, wouldn't he? But, yeah.
Well, so you think he did 128 kilometres, so fairly close to 130.
Yeah, so if you think of... He also won Le Mans in 1971 in a 917K. Yeah. He would have been doing 150-mile-an-hour laps there. Gives you an idea of the different sort of circuit. So you that do 150-mile-an-hour lap average at Le Mans in 1971, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that is a huge difference.
And 70 miles an hour slower at the Targa Florio. Mm-hmm. It's also, I'm sure, the reason that actually, and any death is obviously appalling and tragedy, but so few people died on the Targa Florio. It ran for much, much longer than any of the others.
Because it's just not that fast.
It just wasn't that fast. It started in 1906. It was last. It basically died. It didn't quite die. It lost world championship status in 1973, after the 1973 event, because the FIA mandated that all circuits that were part of the world championship had to have barriers. And clearly, you couldn't put barriers up around that course. So it lost world championship status in 1973, and then it ran, I think, until 1977 as a sort of national event, before it just sort of died completely. And I think in all that time, in 70-something years of running that event, obviously less the war years, I think only six people died.
That's very different to some of the others, isn't it?
Well, where six people was a perfectly, you know, normal head count for a single race. And, you know, certainly something like the Carrera Panamericana, which we will come on to, or any of those early road races. So
to illustrate a little bit further how difficult it was to learn this Piccolo circuit, and again, presumably the locals had a huge advantage there, and they didn't have navigators, so they would share a car with another driver, with a co-driver, but separately, so you didn't have someone in the car with you telling you where to go, like Moss did on the Mille Miglia. Mel Nichols wrote something that was illuminating. He wrote something for us on the app and on the website. He went to the Targa Florio in the, I guess it was in the early 70s. He drove a Corvette around there. But he also sat in a Ferrari Dino with Brian Redman, who was recceeing the lap. So this is before the event one year. And this is the snippet I want to read out. Just as a hard-driving Redman who'd won the 1970 Targa with Joe Siffert in a Porsche 908-03 was pronouncing that he'd at last remember which way the turns went, we darted into what he reckoned was a fast right-hander. It tightened back in on itself hard. Oh, Christ, exclaimed Brian, arms flailing as he flung the Dino around in a lurid slide, this bloody circuit. So the guy who won it still wasn't quite certain which way it went.
The other thing I would say, which actually, and Redman is the perfect illustration of this, which gives you an idea of just how different things were back then. I think it would have been 71, also in a 908-3. He binned it, and it was, he had an enormous accident. There was a big fire. He was badly burnt. He got out the car, and he was eventually ended up in a clinic. It took Porsche 12 hours to find him.
Yeah,
literally, and
that was only when Pedro Rodriguez and Richard Atwood walked into a local clinic, and there he was.
And there he was. And of the car, he told me this. Of the car, all that was left was a hole in the ground with a crankshaft in it.
Oh my god!
Wow. So you know, I mean, you know, the idea that you could simply lose your driver. So you know, you just say bye, Brian, off you know, and he heads off in his lap. And you don't see him again. You have no idea what's happened to him. He's just gone missing. And you find him presumably sometime in the early hours of the following day, you know, badly injured in some clinic somewhere. I can't imagine it.
It's
unthinkable
now. It really is unthinkable. Do you know what? Moss won that one in 55 too.
He did. He did. Yeah.
What a year that was for him. What a year. Okay. Should we move on to the Carrera Panamericana then?
Yeah. Yeah. This was the daddy of road races. This made the Targa and the Mille Miglia look like small beer by comparison. I mean, it was, yeah. I mean, there's crazy, there's nuts, there's totally Tonto, and then there's the Carrera Panamericana. It was insane.
It only ran a few times in the early 50s. Maybe it was too insane. And it was, yeah, people who competed in it considered it to be the most dangerous race of any type in the world. So more than 2,000 miles. And the Pan American Highway runs almost the entire length of the American continents, doesn't it?
It does. It runs from Tierra del Fuego in the south, I mean, other than the Darien Gap, up to Alaska. Yeah.
So extraordinary. And the point of this was that the Mexicans had completed their leg, and they wanted to celebrate that. And so they thought, well, why don't we have a race along it? Which is a brilliant outlook on life. So it's a couple of thousand miles long, and it went from border to border, so all the way through Mexico. And it was an utterly, utterly mad event. There are a couple of famous stories.
A bloke died. Kind of set the tone. A bloke died on the first stage of the first section of the first ever event in 1950.
Bloody hell. Yeah, so that did set the tone, didn't it? Let's talk about 1952, when Kling and Klenk won Mercedes W194. And this is, I'm sure you've heard this story before, all of you listening. This was when they were running along at 120 miles an hour or something. And Kling, driving, failed to spot vultures sitting by the side of the road. As the bird scattered at the roar of the 300SL, one went through the windscreen on Klenk's side, smashed him in the face, knocked him unconscious, and he woke up fairly soon after, I imagine, bleeding badly from facial injuries. And he ordered Kling to carry on, keep going, until their tyre change, 43 miles later.
And yeah, you've just had a photographs of Klenk absolutely covered in blood. Yeah.
And so they got to their tyre stop. They eventually had steel bars, 8 vertical bars fitted down the new windscreen to stop it happening again. And discussing the size of the dead bird, they agreed that had a minimum 115-centimeter wingspan and weighed as much as 5 fattened geese. So it was a monster, this thing. Oh, goodness me. Imagine how much that hurt. And they still went on and won the thing anyway. I want to read this story, which was written by Bobby Unser. It's in his book. And this was when he was a young man competing in the Carrera Panamericana alongside his father. And it goes like this. On the second day, we were in 17th and coming up to pass the car of millionaire Carlos Panini and his daughter, Teresita. She was the registered driver. However, Carlos was behind the wheel instead and was in ill health. He shouldn't have been driving. He didn't even have a driver's license. The rules were that the slower car was to allow the faster car to pass if the faster car honked its horn. We were in the mountains and I came up to Carlos and honked, but he wouldn't let me pass. This went on through about 10 turns with Carlos blocking me each time. We're probably doing about 90 miles per hour at this point. The next time I tried to pass him, he bumped my front right fender, which almost pushed me off a sheer cliff to the left that was some 500 to 800 feet down. My left front tyre went over the edge, but fortunately I regained control of the car. Carlos overcorrected his car to the right and went straight into a solid rock wall. The car exploded on impact like an egg hitting a sidewalk. I didn't know it at the time, but Carlos was killed instantly. One of the rules of the race was that if you stop to help anyone, you are automatically disqualified. Seeing the explosive impact, I wanted to stop to help, but Daddy told me to keep going. He knew the rules and told me that people were there to help. That was hard for me. I slowed down to about 15 or 20 miles per hour. He insisted that I keep going, and grimly I did.
Can I give another little insight into this? Mm. In the 1951 race, it was actually, by Carrera standards, it was quite good on the head count. Only three competitors died. But, yeah, but 750 cows died.
What?
750 cows. Because basically, the marshals, if they saw a cow so much as moo in the direction of the road, take one step, they just shot it.
Shot it. Oh, my God. It's amazing so what they
shot 750 cows. It is just... It's yeah. I mean, I've done the route in a Benz. In fact, I drove some of it in the W194 that came second in 52. And what I just remember is you're going over these high mountain passes, and probably my most abiding memory of it is on the apex of the hairpins when you've got these incredible drops of thousands of feet. They're just crucifixes.
Oh my God!
All around the exit, all around the edges of the road, where over the years, you know, people have just, you know, failed to stop, and you know that was very, very sobering, indeed. And the speeds at which they were going. So the last one, I understand why they stop it. You know, the last one. So the first one was in 1950. Was won by a bloke with a brilliant name, Herschel McGriff. And Herschel McGriff in his Oldsmobile won at 76 miles an hour. By 1954, Umberto Maglioli in a works prototype Ferrari averaged 107 miles an hour. So it was just getting faster and faster and faster. Eight people died that year. The previous year, 1953, nine people had died. And it was just insane. You know, I suspect if it had continued sooner or later, you would have had an absolutely unimaginable calamity. So it kind of, people say, if you read books about it, they'll say it wasn't worried about safety. It was much more to do with financial and political considerations if it got stopped. I don't know how true that is. But yeah, so it ran five times between 1950 and 1954. And that was that.
Bloody hell. I mean, no wonder, no wonder it got binned, even if, I don't know, doesn't bear thinking about really. Well, that's the great road races, an amazing era, but unspeakably dangerous. Well, let's leave it there then. We've got a listener question coming up. Before that, please remember to rate and review the podcast, subscribe or follow wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please do that. It really helps. You have been doing it, but keep going. Also, thank you to JBR Capital for sponsoring the podcast. You'll find contact details in the description below. But if you're looking to buy a new or used car with a value greater than £25,000, go and see what JBR Capital can do for you on the finance side and tell them the Intercooler sent you. So this week's listener question comes from Mike Smith. It's a simple one. What makes a good driving shoe?
What makes a good driving shoe?
Yeah.
It's two things. It's size and it's material. So, you know, it depends what kind of car you're in, but you know, most driving shoes are quite narrow. And so, you know, because you tend to get, you know, in certain, you know, cars like Caterhams and that sort of thing, they tend to have quite cramped footwells. And you absolutely don't want to be treading on two pedals at the same time. In my case, I can only drive it either in socks or in race boots because the pedals are so close together. And the reason for that is, well, A, it's quite cramped down there, but B, you know, you need to be able to heel and toe in those things. So they put the pedals close together. But also the material is quite important. You need to be able to... pretentious, but you need to be able to feel the pedals. You need to, you know, it's a sensory connection to the car. And if you wear big squishy training shoes, which soak it all up, you know, there is, you'd be surprised by how much feel for what the car is doing. You lose through your feet. So you want, you know, a good hard sole, which is going to transmit, the feel of the pedals, to you. They need to be comfortable. One of the things that I think that, you know, shoes don't do, you know, particularly somebody who drives old cars and cars and old race cars and things, where heel and toeing is actually, you know, not just desirable, but crucial, is when your foot goes across to blip the throttle. Certainly the way that I do it, I always end up doing it with, you know, the side of my foot where there isn't a hard sole. And if you're doing a very long race and you're doing like a sort of 1 hour stint, it can end up being quite painful. I know that's kind of like about as first world problem as you're ever going to get. But if there was just a little bit of sort of, I don't know, rubber or hard material specifically designed for that bit of your foot, rather than just using the soft fabric at the side and the top of the shoe for it, that'd be better. Other than that, no, it's just they just need to be the right size and made of the right stuff.
Yeah, and to understand how much of a difference it makes, you only have to wear race boots once. In any car, in a race car, for instance, and you just realise how much more pedal feel you have. And they should also be quite tight, so that there's no slack, there's no give between your foot and the sole of the boot. And then when you've got a good race boot on, tightly done up, it makes a world of difference. So it is an important consideration. It really is. But there we go. Good question. Keep them coming in, however you want to get them across to us. Email us if you like, info@the-intercooler.com, or send us a note on social media. Either way, we'll see it. But get your listener questions across, because we like ending the podcast this way, and we will do it again next week.
See ya.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.